You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Francis Wright, toko ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 14th of August. My name is Francis and I'm your co-host alongside Zazie. Back in the stew, Zazie, how are we feeling?
I could not be feeling better today, Francis, thank you.
That is good to hear. So coming up on the show today, we have our regular segment Dear Science with Alan Blackman. This week we talk about a study that found dogs can tell when people are lying to them, a large meta-analysis that suggests a vegetarian diet is linked to depression, and the world's first green synthesis of plastics from CO2.
I have my regular talk with ACT's Brooke Van Velden, where I talk to her about the Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Bill and the Auckland Cycle Bridge.
And then I speak with Professor Pare Keha, the Dean of the Faculty of Māori and Indigenous Development at the University, Auckland University of Technology. We talk about National's call for a referendum about calling New Zealand Aotearoa.
And finally, I talk to the group editor at Freeman Media, Gavin Evans, about New Zealand's energy sources and the increase in coal imports.
He aha a whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so you can text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95bfm.com.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So, this week on Dear Science, we're joined by Alan Blackman. Kia ora, Alan. Thanks
Hi, Francis.
For being here.
Yeah. Always a pleasure, you know.
Yeah. Let's kick off with this first story about a study that found dogs can tell when people are lying to them.
I know. You sort of wonder how they come up with these sorts of studies, really. Who gets funded to do this sort of stuff? But, you know, it's important to know if dogs are lying to you. So, or if they know that you're lying to them. So these are workers at the University of Vienna in Austria, and they did a study of 260 dog volunteers. Now, I don't know how the dogs were volunteered, obviously by their owners, but...
I volunteer as tribute.
So the way that they did this was that they trained all of these dogs, and this must have taken, you know, a decent whack of time anyway. So they trained all of the dogs to follow the advice of somebody who was telling them that there was a treat in a particular dog bowl. So they had two dog bowls, and in one of them was a hidden treat. And so they trained up all of the dogs with this one particular person who was unknown to the dog. And they would say, right, the treat's in that bowl. And the dog would, you know, go to that bowl, find the treat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what then happened was the dog learned to follow the directions of that particular person and learned to trust them, essentially. And then once all that was done, and as I say, goodness knows how long that took, then they switched things around a little bit. So what they then did was that they brought in some other people, and they then let the dogs look at the treats being placed in the particular bowls. So the dogs knew who was placing the treats in the bowls, and they also knew where the treats were. And then they would repeat the experiment, the original experiment that they did with somebody telling the dog that the treat is here or there. Now, they did this in two ways. So the first way was that they brought somebody new in who was not there when the treats were placed in the bowls. And so obviously this person didn't know which bowl the treat was in, so they were just sort of pointing randomly. And amazingly, the dogs figured that out. The dogs figured out that the person wasn't there when the treats were put in the bowl, so they would not know where the treats were. So the dogs started ignoring their advice. They'd been trained to take their advice, but they knew that this person didn't know. And furthermore, they then brought back the original person, who was then going to tell them untruths, obviously. And again, the dogs knew. The dogs knew where the treats were. They'd been trained to trust the human. The human was giving them wrong information, and so the human was lying to them. The dogs knew.
Wow, goodness. Do you have a dog, Ellen?
No, I don't. I've got three cats, or we've got three cats actually. Oh, so yes.
Do you lie to your cats?
Occasionally, you know, when you're trying to get them out of the house or something like that. Come on, treats. Yeah,
yeah. I also like my cat, Alan, don't worry.
Let's move on to this meta-analysis that suggests vegetarian diets are linked to high depression scores.
Yeah, interesting this, very interesting. And again, kind of an interesting topic to study. Who sort of thought this up? Just something random. People think, you know, what are the causes of depression? Might be diet, which is, you know, a fair enough supposition, I guess. And so, in fact, there are quite a few studies in the literature of this particular topic of whether there is any link between diet, in this case, vegetarian diet, and depression. And indeed, if you go to the literature, as these people did, you'll find varying answers to that question. So some findings were that, yes, there is seemingly some link. Other findings saying, no, there's a distinctly opposite link, that people on vegetarian diets are happier, et cetera, et cetera. So they decided to do this thing called a meta-analysis, where you basically go through the literature and you weed out the rubbish, really. And, you know, this is sad that there is rubbish in the literature, but there is. And so these workers who are in Germany, they decided to use some very, very strict criteria to basically say, right, this is a good study, this isn't a good study, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there were, I think, 37 odd studies in the literature. And of those, they went through and applying those strict criteria, they found 13 that they were then going to study. And in these 13 studies, there were around about 50,000 participants, around about 42,000 of whom were meat eaters, and around about 8,000 of whom were vegetarians. And then, having picked out these studies, they would then go and do some heavy statistical analysis of all of this sort of stuff. And basically, the finding was, yes, that there is a definite correlation here, that vegetarian diets do seem to be linked with high rates of depression.
Wow.
And that's very interesting, a very, very interesting finding.
And they have sort of, do they have any idea why that is?
Well, this is the whole thing about causation. This is this whole question. So, yes, there does appear to be a link, but they warned against sort of taking any inferences from this, because there's two ways that you can look at this. You could say, right, the vegetarian diet causes depression, or, and this might sound weird, depression causes the vegetarian diet. So in other words, people who are depressed, very possibly being in that particular unfortunate situation, then start thinking about taking better care of themselves, eating better, exercising, all of that sort of stuff, and then as a result of that, switching to a vegetarian diet.
Okay.
So you can't say which is causing which.
Right.
And
so they're linked.
Yeah, so there's a definite link. And what they also, well, so, I mean, the problem with anything to do with diet, is there's just so many variables that you can either take account of or probably you can't really. And one of these variables was gender. They were thinking that there's a lot more female vegetarians than males, so maybe that had some effect here that was skewing the results, but they allowed for that in their statistical analysis, and that was found to not be the case. So that's basically the guts of it, that yes, there's certainly some sort of link. However, the 50,000 people that they were surveying were very much from sort of a minority of countries, only from a couple of countries. And so what they really are thinking, that if they're going to look at this in more detail in the future, they're going to have to go to a lot wider number of countries, you know, larger number of countries, and see if this then replicates across, I guess, different cultures, et cetera, et cetera. So, very interesting. So, all you vegetarians out there, you know, don't be too worried about this necessarily, because the fact that you're vegetarian isn't going to necessarily lead to depression. But, you know, the actual link that is there does seem to certainly be there. It's just a matter of, you know, what that link is and why it's there.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah, kind of interesting.
I just want to thank the person quickly that texted in just before saying that lying to your dog is a bit rough, R-U-F-F. Just thought I'd share that with you guys.
Just to go back to that, actually, that they have repeated that experiment with young children and chimpanzees and macaques, and in all of those cases, they found that the kids and the chimps and everything, they actually ended up trusting the people. So even when the people were lying to them, they would trust them more often than not. So dogs basically are untrustworthy. There you go.
Dog detectives. And finally, Ellen, this is quite exciting. Let's talk about the world's first synthesis of plastics from carbon dioxide.
Yeah, carbon dioxide, eh? You know, everybody knows that it is bad for the environment, and sadly, carbon dioxide is the fate of every carbon atom on planet Earth. Every carbon atom left to itself is eventually going to turn into carbon dioxide. And when that happens, we're all going to be well and truly out of here. So we don't want that happening, so we're going to have to find uses for CO2, which is not necessarily the easiest thing in the world, because, as I said, sort of CO2 is the end result of all combustion reactions, so getting it to go the other way is a difficult thing. However, what you can do is to utilize CO2 in various chemical processes, and one of these is to make polymers, things called polycarbonates. So you may have heard of these sorts of very, very tough plastic things, polycarbonates, and you can make them from CO2. And so a bunch of researchers in Japan have just very recently published what they call a green synthesis of these polycarbonates. And green chemistry is a big thing at the moment, obviously trying to minimize waste and maximize efficiency so that, you know, you don't get all of these nasty byproducts and stuff like that. And so these guys have done this. They've done this particular process at atmospheric pressure as well, so we're not using enormous amounts of energy having to pressurize up the CO2 in order to get this to react. They've just managed to do it with a special catalyst, a thing called cerium dioxide, and that is one of these rare earth elements, cerium, that you may have heard of. And it seems to be a very, very facile process and quite an exciting process. Obviously, the more CO2 you can tie up in things like this, the better. And, you know, ironically, you're actually making plastics. You know, plastics are the next bad thing as well, aren't they? But ironically, you can use CO2 to make these plastics. And so these polycarbonates, they can then be used further in things like polyurethanes and stuff like that. All of these different types of polymers that you can then make from these polycarbonates. So this is kind of exciting that potentially, you know, we have a use for significant amounts now of CO2. And as soon as you make that commercially viable, then people are going to do it. So, you know, more power to them, I guess. So all good.
Yeah, cool. That's quite exciting technology, isn't it? Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for joining us today, Ellen.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
And we will see you in a few weeks.
Absolutely. Shall do.
Namahi. All right.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was Alan Blackman on this week's Dear Science. He aha o whakaaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio 309-3879. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. We'll be back after some ads.
At Be Nourished, they're committed to bringing you the benefits of organic fermented vegetables with their nourishing, cultured, living foods. Just one tablespoon of their organic kimchi or sauerkrauts has enough probiotics to see you through the day. Plus, all of Be Nourished products are free from pesticides, so you can rest assured that they're keeping any nasties away from the soil and away from your body. Be Nourished organic sauerkrauts and kimchi for a good, healthy gut. Available at selected supermarkets, your local organic or specialty store, and online at benourished.nz.
Southbound Records, New Zealand's largest range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need, brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more. Their in-store experts can help you out whatever genre you're into. So support your local and head into Southbound today. Southbound Records, your vinyl specialist. Pop in at 132 Simon Street or order online.
Don't stop when your period starts.
The Lunette Menstrual Cup is the easy, hygienic, reusable alternative to pads and tampons.
Convenient and comfortable, it's made from 100% hypoallergenic medical silicone. Lunette is safe, smooth and sustainable.
Great for you, great for the planet, great for your wallet. Live life to the fullest, all month, every month, with the Lunette Menstrual Cup. All it takes is the first step.
Go to lunette.co.nz. That's lunette.co.nz.
Not all bread is created equal. In fact, some bread is pretty shit.
You might as well be spreading your Marmite on a chocolate bar.
Bread and Butter's sourdough is real bread, using ancient techniques and organic and regeneratively grown ingredients. Choose substance over speed.
Choose age and beauty.
Check out their online delivery options or head in store for brunch, great coffee and more homemade pastries than you can shake a baguette at.
Bread and Butter, the best sourdough in town.
Breadandbutter.nz.
Wow. Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The August playlist features Nice Girl, Gino October, Deep State and Baby Girl.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
So, we're back. How are we feeling, Francis?
Oh, pretty good.
Yeah?
Interesting science chat there.
Yeah, who do you think's more untrustworthy, cats or dogs, after that discussion?
Gonna say cats.
Yeah, they're still pretty brutal, eh?
Yeah.
Well, segueing on, nice and smooth. On the 30th of July. Oh, we're gonna talk to Brooke Van Velden.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
So, on the 30th of July, the government announced the Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Bill, following through with Labor's election promise to ban gay conversion therapy. Today, ACT's Brooke Van Velden spoke about the party stance on this bill, why they have hesitations, and what they would like the next step to be in terms of developing the bill further. Why does the ACT Party have concerns with the current state of the bill?
So the ACT Party came out yesterday in support of the intention behind the Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Bill. And I think it's important just to outline what that hopes to achieve. And that is the ACT Party belief that everybody should have the liberty, the ability to live a free and full life. So if you're gay or gender diverse, it doesn't matter. People should be able to feel confident that they can be themselves in our New Zealand society. And that's an inclusive society that we want to live in. What the Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Bill hopes to achieve is banning gay conversion therapy. And that's for people under the age of 18. And I also believe that people should not be forced into gay conversion therapy. The issue that the ACT Party has with the bill as it's drafted is that it appears to cross into that parent-child relationship. So if you have, say, a 13-year-old child who is struggling with their sexuality and their gender identity, there is an ability there for that child to take hormone blockers to stop puberty onset, but for a parent not to be able to be included in that. And in doing so and stopping their child taking hormone blockers, being prosecuted. And I think there are a lot of parents out there in New Zealand who would be really struggling with the idea that their child could see a therapist and start on a trajectory of stopping puberty onset, but them having concerns not being able to be part of that conversation with their child.
Chris Farfoy has said that the purpose of this bill is not to criminalise anyone, let alone parents, but instead it is about having open discussions with young people and people of all ages about sexual orientation and gender. Isn't this legislation more about normalising LGBTQ+ conversations rather than penalising them?
Well, you're absolutely right that that's what he has said the intent of the bill is. But when questioned by the media on whether parents would be prosecuted, he couldn't say whether or not they would be. And I think that is hugely concerning to many parents around the country who do want to have normalised conversations with their children about gender and sexuality, but being afraid that whatever they may say could in fact end them up being prosecuted. Now, I think we do have to admit that we live in a very diverse society. We have people who have a range of different religions, and that's through all sorts of different age groups. And I think there are a lot of people who do want to be inclusive of their children, even if it doesn't fall under their particular religion. But not being sure with whether their conversations would fall within or without the mark of this law, I think is really concerning. So the ACTA is saying that we do support part of the intent and we would send it to select committee so parents can have a say on the law and that lawyers can actually go through it and see whether it's drafted as it's intended.
So do you agree that this issue should be ironed out within the legislative process here in New Zealand? Because the bill is set to go through three readings, select committee and public submissions.
I do believe it should be taken through that consultative process. So the ACT Party said that we would support it at the first reading. And what that allows is for members of the public, people who are legal experts, for the minister, for a range of people who may work as therapists and counsellors in the space to have conversations with members of parliament about how they interact with people who undergo conversion therapy of choice, how they interact with people who are questioning their sexuality, parents about how they would like to be involved in the process with puberty blockers too. Because the important thing here is that we're listening to people's concerns to make sure that if this law does pass, that it's not capturing people who it never intended to criminalise or prosecute.
Brooke and I then move on to discuss the Auckland Cycle Bridge, its benefit-cost ratio, and whether Brooke believes catering to cyclists is important. Why is the ACT Party not on board with the cycle bridge?
Well, we've seen a range of movement here with the cycle bridge that was proposed underneath the Auckland Harbour Bridge. And the benefit-cost ratio that the government's own advisers produced showed that the costs of the bridge outweighed its benefits. So to put numbers around that, for every $1 that New Zealand taxpayers would be spending on it, they'd be losing 60 cents because it wasn't going to be deemed a good investment. And the problem that I have with this is that this announcement of the cycle bridge was made at a time when the nurses said that they were going on strike. So I believe it was a distraction to take the media, who they believed would be in favour, take the public, who they believed would be in favour of the cycle bridge, could distract them from another problem. Now, after announcing this bridge, the Labour Party has actually seen a 10-point drop in its own polling, and they've decided, well, maybe we're not going to go ahead with the bridge after all. I don't believe they expected such backlash to the idea of the bridge, and I believe they don't actually have an intention now to continue with it.
Coming back to your point about the benefit-cost ratio, even with the BCR being less than 1.0, isn't it important for Auckland to try and shift its transport network to cater to more green transport like bikes, scooters and walking? Because Auckland specifically relies heavily on driving a vehicle because of the way the city has been organised.
I think there needs to be more acceptability of the reality of how people actually do get around. You know, if you take, for example, a mother who is needing to drop their one kid off at school and then they've got to go to work and then in another direction, it's very hard to say that this cycle bridge is actually going to solve any problem for them. What we need to see is a better functioning system, so more free-flowing traffic. And I think this bike bridge won't actually solve a congestion problem. All it really does is help the Lycra lobby, the people who live between two of the richest suburbs in the country, biking from one side of the bridge to the other. This is not going to help any first-home buyer, for example, who is buying out in South Auckland, who still needs to get back into work It's for a very small number of people, and it's a huge cost that doesn't see an added benefit.
So do you see any importance in finding ways to connect the North Shore and Auckland City for people on all different modes of transport?
I'm open to different ideas on how we can get our transport network better functioning. But what I don't see is the ability to force people into new modes of transport. We haven't seen a huge uptake in cycleways because people do want that flexibility of having a car and being able to travel to multiple places on any given day. And I think my focus is on real people who are sitting in traffic in Auckland who know that they can only afford a home on the outskirts of the city and they still need their job in town. They need that flexibility of a well-functioning road network rather than a focus from this government on policies that are intended to create support for the Labor Party and not actually benefit New Zealanders.
The government also has another project underway, the second Waitemata crossing, which is likely to be a tunnel. What are your thoughts on this option as an alternative?
I haven't looked into the benefit-cost ratio of that particular project, so I'd have to get back to you on that specific one. But what I do know is that this Labor Party is extremely cynical and is making policies based on who they believe will support them at any given time and based on polling, rather than on an analysis of whether projects stack up. So having a benefit-cost ratio of around 0.4 is a huge cost to New Zealand taxpayers without the benefits that the government would hope to see from a project, and we should not be making decisions based on such bad data.
That was Brooke Van Velden talking about the Conversion Practices Prohibition Legislation Bill and the Auckland Cycle Bridge.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
You're on The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Frances and I'm your co-host alongside Zazie. National leader Judith Collins has backed calls on a referendum calling New Zealand Aotearoa. This comes after National MP Stuart Smith posted a column on Tuesday saying that while he doesn't have a personal view on the use of the word Aotearoa, New Zealanders should be consulted on the use of it by government. This morning I spoke with Professor Pare Keha. He is the Pro Vice Chancellor for Māori Advancement, Dean of the Faculty of Māori and Indigenous Development, and Dean of the Faculty of Culture and Society at the Auckland University of Technology. We spoke about the significance of calling New Zealand Aotearoa and his hope for the future of the word Aotearoa as a national and cultural identifier. I began by asking him what his reaction was to National's referendum call.
Very much like many, I thought the call was somewhat absurd.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit, in what regard?
Well, there was a wonderful headline in the papers over the last fortnight, which, amongst other things, was written by a New Zealander who argued that he was born in New Zealand and now lives in Aotearoa. The Aotearoa in which we live in today is not the New Zealand into which I was born, when, amongst other things, I can recall stories by my grandparents being thrashed at school for speaking Te Reo. We can remember the stories of Dame Nadia Glavish being criticised for welcoming callers and using the very simple greeting, kia ora. We can remember Hinawehi Mohi being publicly vilified for singing the New Zealand national anthem in Te Reo Māori. And yet, in my lifetime, I recently attended the Toi Tu Toi Ora exhibition, at which there were a number of docents speaking Te Reo to young New Zealanders as though it was normal. And so, as with all democracies, over time, we gather, we acquire a new confidence in our identity. But what I find somewhat perplexing is why we would want to hold on to a name which, amongst other things, was given to us by a Dutchman many, many centuries ago, where we're named after a very obscure province in the Netherlands. And so there does have to be some soul-searching. But, of course, this is consistent with the nature of politics, the nature of politics ought to be to cohere, to bring together, to support and develop our identity. In many instances, in my instance, the son of the soils of Aotearoa. I'm not a son of the soils of Zealand. I'm not a son of the soils of England. And I'm not a son of the soils of the Netherlands. And many New Zealanders, irrespective of their ethnicity, are increasingly holding a similar view. So whether it be the politics of a previous National Party, led by the likes of Don Brash, or indeed the current politics of the National Party, there are many instances in which we should all be concerned about politicians who wish to divide, politicians who wish to use their power and their privilege to speak about things that frankly do not matter.
And from the responses I've seen to this comment that Stuart Smith made, it sort of feels as though people think the National Party is attacking all things Māori and the reconciliation and recognition of Te Tiriti. Do you think that that's the case?
It's somewhat problematic that they have not thought through the consequences of their actions. An intelligent, if not more respectful person, would give consideration to the effect of what they might say on others, and whether it's the effect on young Māori or indeed the effects of young New Zealanders who have brought up to regularly form the haka, to regularly sing the New Zealand National Anthem and te reo, that those things which they consider to be normal, rather problematically, is not considered to be normal or indeed as right to be respected by certain members of the National Party.
And can we just take it back and speak about the significance of the word Aotearoa, what it means and where it comes from and the significance that it holds?
Well, I think there's a lot of debate about where it might have come from. That debate, of course, isn't helpful. What really matters is that many of us have embraced a word, a name, which better represents our identity as sons and daughters of the soils of Aotearoa, and that is part of the natural maturation of a democratic and nation state. So its origins of itself aren't important. What matters is that we're exploring for ourselves a new identity born out of debate, born out of our challenges to better acquire an identity which is much more confident and much more optimistic. Our history only matters to us if it provides us confidence about our present and consequently optimism about our future. And am I optimistic? Absolutely. Do I really care, personally, about whether or not we are called New Zealand or Aotearoa? No, I don't. What I care about is that we're capable of engaging in respectful debate and dialogue so that over time a democratic process will allow the majority of those of us born in this country to have acquired an identity which is much more uniquely ours.
Is the fact that all the other parties in Parliament criticise National Suggestion, is that encouraging to you?
Well, I think one of the things which you all must be aware of is the difference between criticism and critique. It is far too easy to throw stones. It is far too easy to make ad hominem attacks rather than clearly looking at what the issue is. And without our ability to analyse, to critique and debate respectfully, then we become no better than stone throwers.
What is your hope for the continuation of this? I mean, it's been brought into the limelight now and it's circulating through the media and we're having these discussions. Where do you hope that future discussion will go?
My hopes in many respects have been realised much more quickly than I could ever have imagined. For example, I could never have imagined that the Auckland City Art Gallery would have employed 6 docents to speak te reo to significant groups of young New Zealanders as if it was normal. Many of us could never have hoped that the singing of the national anthem in te reo Māori could have taken place in our lifetime. I have the great privilege of being Dean of the Faculty of Modern Indigenous Development here at the Auckland University of Technology. And it is regular for me to hear our students speaking naturally in Te Reo Māori. The most frequently searched term on the AET website is Te Reo. Majority of my Te Reo students are not Māori. A significant number of the New Zealand media, both on the radio and on the television, have been through my faculty here at the Auckland University of Technology. And therefore, I'm proud to be dean of a faculty or a community of scholars who have regularly, assiduously, and dutifully taught our first language to large numbers of New Zealanders who, amongst other things, now have a stronger sense of what it is to live in Aotearoa, albeit the fact that we currently live in New Zealand. And so I'm reasonably confident that over time, it is most likely that we will change our flag. It is most likely that we will change our name. But they will be products, I would like to think, of respectful, informed debate and discussion, where all views should be respectfully considered, weighed up and assessed. Because, amongst other things, we're currently discussing in New Zealand the merits or otherwise of the freedom of speech, and at extremes we refer to as hate speech. All these discussions are important to ensure that young New Zealanders of your generation, if not younger, live in a country which is better educated, safer and healthier.
That was Professor Parekeha from Auckland University of Technology speaking with me about National's call for a referendum on calling New Zealand Aotearoa.
We'll be back after a little break. Here is Mo Windows by Maratike.
Top of the stairs, in a minute I'll be right there.
They're committed to bringing you the benefits of organic fermented vegetables with their nourishing, cultured, living foods. Just one tablespoon of their organic kimchi or sauerkrauts has enough probiotics to see you through the day. Plus, all of Be Nourished products are free from pesticides, so you can rest assured that they're keeping any nasties away from the soil and away from your body. Be Nourished organic sauerkrauts and kimchi for a good, healthy gut. Available at selected supermarkets, your local organic or specialty store, and online at benourished.nz.
On the prowl for your new friendly local? Look no further than Scarecrow, the cafe with great food and groceries. Plentiful vegan fare also, alongside a great buzz. Right beside Albert Park, Scarecrow is located at 33 Victoria Street East. Explore their range of food, which is rated amongst the best in town by Heart of the City. Browse their gifts, local flowers, organic teas and coffees. You can also find them at 811 Mount Eden Road. To learn more, call them on 09377 133 or shop online for Auckland-wide delivery at scarecrow.co.nz.
Oh, what a beautiful moment. The sun's setting all purple and gold.
You can still see where your dad hired a plane to skywrite. Actually, I am proud of you.
Yeah. I wish I had somewhere to capture this memory. Just, you know, a static image to immortalise this moment.
Look, 1,000 butterflies.
Take a picture. It'll last longer. And whatever your level, you'll take better ones with Pro Gear. 100% camera, 0% bullshit. Pro Gear, 3 Railway Street, Newmarket. Or go to progear.co.nz.
Well, it's you, but from the future. Hurry, we don't have long. It's only a matter of hours before blenders start to think for themselves.
Yo, this is hectic. Do you think I still have time to make a smoothie? It feels like it might be my last one for a while.
Join Motat every Friday night in August for their movie series, Visions of the Future. This week, it's the original Men in Black, so get ready for a bit of supernatural. Tickets are $10 and include popcorn and candy floss. This is an R18 event. Find out more and book your tickets at motat.nz.
Oh, what a day. I love e-scootering. The great outdoors, Richmond Road.
Oh, I've been loving that new Drill Wave Crew synthesis with a C.
Well, we're signed up to My Music Bag. It's so flex. Whatever you're into, they send the same but different stuff in ready-to-bang portions.
Isn't that kind of cheating? I mean, I'm old school. Suggested YouTube videos, Shazam stuff off Netflix. And don't you have all those leftover bass lines?
Obviously, I donate the bass lines here at Vinny's.
The Swap Meet. Old collector guys bring you disco, boogie, funk, and soul to get you cooking. The Swap Meet with Jabden Kirk. Sundays 4 till 7 on 95 BFM.
Oi, don't leave your bass lines lying around here.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
This is The Wire with Francis Nzazi on 95BFM. He aha or whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of today's pieces. You can text us on 5395 or give us a call in the studio on 309 3879.
New Zealand's rise in coal imports has been a major topic of discussion over the past 2 weeks, with last week's announcement informing New Zealand that we are likely to import more coal this year than in any year prior. The government estimates an additional 150,000 tonnes of coal being imported by the shipload, which is 14% more than last year's 1 million tonnes. Last week, my co-host Francis Wright spoke to Forests and Birds Regional Manager for the Top of the South Island, Debs Martin, and this week I spoke with Gavin Evans, who is the Group Editor at Freeman Media, producing Energy News, Inside Resources and Capital Letter. Gavin and I also spoke about New Zealand's coal. He discussed why we haven't moved away from coal as of yet, if it will have any major effects on climate change and global warming, and where New Zealand stands with coal in comparison to other countries around the world. Why have our coal imports been increasing in the past few years?
Yeah, so imports have been going up largely because we've been gradually losing gas supply. A lot of our gas fields are quite a bit older now, and production's been tailing off, and it really started falling quite rapidly after about 2018 at the Pohokura field, which is our biggest gas field. And I mean, just for instance, gas normally accounts for about sort of a fifth of all the energy New Zealand uses. So if gas supply starts falling, that has an impact sort of straight away, and that we have to fill the gap with something, and it's generally coal.
And using coal to fill the gap when gas supply starts falling, will we ever be able to move away from both of these not-so-green energy sources?
We are going to move away from gas, just as we are moving away from coal. It's just that the fall-off from Pohokura has been so sharp, and it's also, this year, it's coincided with a dry period, so we've had a sort of double whammy effect, because normally, if our hydro lakes were low, we would lean on gas a bit more. If the gas isn't there, then we have to lean on coal more. And, you know, coal has a lot more emissions. But it's actually quite good. It's quite a useful backup fuel for these dry years that we have every, you know, 6 or 7 years. Reducing our gas use is still in place. But we're going to be relying on gas for a long time yet. So it's a matter of how we wean ourselves off gas where we can and yet still keep a big enough gas industry for it to be viable, because that's actually quite tricky to do those two things.
Are there cleaner alternatives to coal or gas that we could be potentially using instead?
Yeah, for some applications there certainly are, and a lot of industries are already moving away from coal, to a lesser extent gas, because gas doesn't have quite the same emissions, so there's a bigger benefit, if you like, from cutting out coal use. So a lot of the food processing firms, the ones who don't have a really high heat requirement like a big dairy plant, they're moving quite quickly now, generally to wood chips and that sort of thing. Some are moving to electricity because we've got heat pumps, big industrial scale heat pumps now, which can, if you only need hot water, you know, you really don't need to burn anything to do that. You can generally get it off an electrical supply. It's not necessarily cheap, but, you know, a lot of firms are doing it.
Yeah, and adding on from that, the energy sector has committed more than $1 billion to renewable projects this year, geothermal and wind sources included. Why can't these energy sources be used instead of coal?
Okay, so that's fine. I mean, geothermal, wind, solar, all those things are really good, and you're right, we're developing a lot more of those quite quickly. But electricity isn't always that good for what we call thermal heat requirements. You know, if you're trying to dry milk, it would be very expensive to try and do it with electricity. You know, it just doesn't work that well. So we tend to use gas on the North Island, and in the South Island, where there's no sort of piped gas line network, we tend to rely on coal. In the future, we'll probably, those big sites will probably be a mix of all kinds of fuels. You'll have low heat requirements met with electricity, sort of medium grade heats will be met with biomass, wood, and some will probably be met with coal. In the North Island, we've already got some dairy plants that run on geothermal heat, which is really quite clever. But it's a bit, but you've got to be near a geothermal field to have that option. The other thing with coal is, you know, there are some processes that we just need coal for. You know, if we're going to make steel up at Glenbrook, we need coal. That's just one of the ingredients. If we're going to have a dry year backup supply, maybe coal is a good option for that, because it's also a good backup if we ever have another gas shortage. And we have had those in the past. So, you know, different forms of energy have different roles and can play, you know, have different roles to play in the system. And you probably want a mix, and you probably want that mix to be as low emissions as possible, but you don't want to close off your options too quickly.
Does that mean that coal will still be one of our main sources of generating energy?
Well, it's not really a very big part of our energy system now. You know, if in a wet year at the moment, coal might make sort of 1% or 2% of our electricity, if that. You know, at one stage we were using so little coal for making electricity that it almost became uneconomic to supply it from local mines. That's why we import so much of it for that role. But we are going to, you know, I think we're still going to need it for making steel for a while, and we're probably still going to need it on the South Island for industrial heat for a while. Not anywhere near the volumes that we do now, but I think it is going to still be in use for a bit. And gas will be around for longer because, you know, gas can fill that role, but with less emissions.
Do you have any concerns about using coal as an energy source regarding global warming and climate change?
Well, I think the thing with global warming and climate change is that it's not so much the fuels you use that you should worry about. You should be focused on emissions. And there's lots of ways of reducing your emissions. I mean, if we use less gas and we use less coal, we'll have fewer emissions without a doubt. But there might be there's some things in New Zealand that, and this is already happening, you know, we could shut our steel mill at Glenbrook, but then we'd have to import the steel anyway. So we wouldn't be burning coal there, you know, to make steel, and it would look good on New Zealand's emissions balance sheet. But we'd be kidding ourselves because the emissions would still be made offshore wherever we were importing our steel from. So we've got to be a bit honest about this process. If we're going to use these products that have, you know, carbon embedded in them, then I tend to think we should take responsibility for them here, you know, where we can actually control them a bit more.
So do you think our current coal usage will have a long-lasting effect on climate change?
The level of coal imports we've got right now, you know, are just bad for emissions. You know, hands down, you can't deny it. It would be more useful if we had better gas supplies, and it would be a lot more useful if the government would come up with a sensible gas policy, because, you know, there's a lot of work underway to fix our gas supplies. There's a lot of money being spent to do that, but that work will only last so long. And, you know, if we don't have proper policy frameworks, we'll stop investing in gas, and then we'll be in exactly the same position again, you know, further down the track. Because, you know, there's no point in having electricity, no point in trying to get people to drive electric cars, you know, and put factories onto electricity if the supplies aren't reliable and if they're monstrously expensive, because that's the price you pay. If you try and do these things too quickly, or you try and, you know, selectively take out some energy forms.
Compared to other countries in the world, is New Zealand's coal usage high or low?
Compared with the rest of the world, our coal use is tiny. Our coal is about, I think it's about 7% of our, what's called our primary energy in New Zealand. In the rest of the world, it's about a quarter of all the energy that gets used. And it's about 35% of all the electricity in the world is actually made with coal. People don't realise how well off we are in New Zealand. And yet we quibble about, you know, these small amounts of coal that get used when we have a dry period or breakdown with the gas sector.
So this amount of coal that's been imported, that number's not here to stay in terms of future imports or future
Hopefully
usage?
Hopefully not. I mean, but it's going to take a couple of years to get the gas supply right again. So I think we will be burning more coal than usual for the next few years. I just hope it's not too much.
That was Group Editor at Freeman Media, Gavin Evans, speaking on New Zealand's energy sources and increase in coal imports.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hotaka katoa mo tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the show for another week.
A big thanks to everyone who spoke with us for the show today.
Alan Blackman, Brooke Van Velden, Professor Pare Keha and Gavin Evans. Thank you so much to all of you for tuning in and sending us your texts and giving us a call. We always love to hear your thoughts and feedback. Thanks, Darcy.
No, thank you, Francis.
We'll catch you next time. Up next, a bit of Neil Young and then Bridges Up with the 1-4. You're listening to 95 BFM.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.